Welcome to All Sides with Dan Fisher. Journalists, farmers, filmmakers, and many others see a lot of commercial potential in unmanned aerial vehicles, or as we know them commonly, drones. But the Federal Aviation Administration still rules the skies. Updated regulations on drone technology are due by September 2015. The challenge is deciding which uses are legal and safe until then. Coming up, we'll hear from the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio about privacy and other concerns. We'll also learn about how drone technology could be adapted for news gathering. Joining us now by phone is Ohio University Electrical Engineering Professor Michael Brausch. Welcome to the show.
Oh, good to be with you.
You're the former director of the Avionics Engineering Center at OU, and that's where you're studying how to fly them safely, how to navigate drones safely.
That's correct. We have been looking at navigation systems for aircraft for many decades, but with the growing interest in unmanned vehicles, we've turned our attention to how to fly these things safely in the national airspace.
Is it that much different than having a human operated operation?
Well, there are a couple of key distinctions with unmanned vehicles, and it does have to do with the lack of a human in the cockpit itself. And so, for example, in manned aircraft, there is a requirement to so-called see and avoid. That's a very common sense requirement that the pilot needs to observe what other traffic is in his or her vicinity and obviously avoid them. Don't hit other airplanes, don't hit obstacles, things of that nature, a very common sense requirement. Well, when you talk about trying to do that with what effectively is a robot, it's a little harder. How do you make sure that the electronics in the sky are able to see everything out there and then take the correct evasive maneuvers? Similarly, there's requirements that if you're following the instructions from air traffic controllers and for some reason the radio communication link is lost for some reason, then there are some specific procedures that the pilots need to follow in order to continue conducting the flight in a safe manner. And trying to automate all that and take the human out of the loop turns out to be a bit challenging.
Is there any way to fly drones without having somebody navigating that drone? So there's going to be a human involved at some point?
Well, certainly there are different kinds of operations so that in some unmanned vehicles, you have what's called a remote operator or a remote pilot who is effectively directing the aircraft to fly to a certain waypoint or to circle in a particular location. But there is also the potential for having the aircraft effectively fly on its own. We're not at the point yet where the aircraft are really making decisions on their own. The artificial intelligence hasn't reached that point, but certainly the aircraft electronics are capable of having the vehicle fly a pre-programmed route, for example.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Michael Brausch. He's a professor of electrical engineering at Ohio University. He works in the Avionics Engineering Center. He's a former director of that center where they study how to fly drones safely, among other things. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about drones this hour. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So this is a growing field. As we were doing our research, we noticed that there's lots of universities with this subspecialty out there.
Yes, it's been an area of intense interest as the technology allows universities to be able to do the research without a large investment. You can buy a model aircraft sized vehicle for a few hundred or a few thousand dollars, and you can conduct flight operations without breaking the bank. So a lot of universities have gotten involved in this research.
What's the difference between, I guess, for lack of a better, a typical drone, a garden variety drone, and model aircraft, which most people are familiar with by now?
Sure. Well, at the very low end, the answer could be very little. The things that you can buy off the shelf nowadays have a tremendous amount of capability in terms of being able to stabilize themselves and fly with very little input from the operator. And a lot of the hobby aircraft even have cameras on them nowadays, and that imagery can be linked down to a monitor that the operator is using or the person is using on the ground. Now, when you talk specifically about, well, all right, so you have somebody who's buying UAV for a purpose other than hobbies, then what is the distinction? And typically, it has to do with how long the vehicle can fly. Hobby aircraft typically can, small ones only fly for a few minutes or maybe 10 minutes or so. So the ones that are used for non-hobby purposes generally have longer flight times. They can have more sophisticated navigation and guidance systems. They can have more sophisticated sensor packages on them, things of that nature.
How much does the flight time play into the cost of the drone and that sort of thing?
Well, it's pretty significant. On the lower end, a lot of the small UAVs that are certainly used for hobby purposes are electric, and the battery packs can generally only power the vehicles for, as I said, something on the order of maybe 5 to 15 minutes. In order to be able to go much beyond that, then you have to either have fairly large battery packs that makes the vehicle larger and more complicated, more expensive, or if electric power isn't sufficient, then you might have to be talking about a gas engine, and then that becomes quite large and obviously very noisy as well.
We heard recently about a fellow who lost his drone, was actually putting up signs around the neighborhood, "If anybody sees my drone, please call this number." How could somebody lose a drone?
Well, what you find when you operate them is that if they get more than a few hundred feet away from you, they can be very difficult to see. And this is something that the model aircraft community has known for decades, that you have to be very careful about keeping the aircraft within your line of sight and actually close enough that you can see it maneuver. They don't have to get very far away before they're very difficult to see. And so it requires that the operator be very careful. If the sun angle changes, you have, depending on the contrast in the background sky, you could all of a sudden lose sight of where the vehicle is. And if you're not careful, it can be heading in a certain direction and you don't know how to turn it back to go home. So it can happen. Obviously, that's really carelessness on the part of the operator, but it can happen.
The Federal Aviation Administration director said in a recent interview that he was concerned that drones may need to be treated differently. Let's listen.
And I think that we as a government need to figure out, is there something unique about this technology that would cause us to treat it differently than the constitutional protections you already have?
Is there a sense from the work you've done with drones, Michael Brausch, that they should be treated differently than the protections we already have?
Well, they need to be handled appropriate to their capabilities, and certainly we have many, many decades of experience in this country of people operating model aircraft for hobby purposes. But now that we have the opportunity to use similar aircraft or even smaller aircraft for additional purposes as well, the regulations need to be put in place to permit that. If you have a real estate agent who wants to have a small vehicle pulled out of the back of their car so that they can throw it up a couple dozen feet in the air and take a nice picture of a house that they're trying to put on the market, we need the regulations in place to permit people to do that.
I guess I want you to put on your pull out your crystal ball now, and just given your knowledge of the technology and where it's at now, how soon do you see drones becoming something of a part of our everyday lives?
Well, I think it's going to happen certainly before the end of this decade, that we're going to start seeing routine uses of unmanned vehicles for various purposes. There are, as I said, all sorts of applications where folks would like to be able to take pictures from the sky. You're going to be talking later in the hour about the use of UAVs for journalistic purposes. There's lots of applications where folks would really be able to use a camera that was 20, 30 feet up in the air and take a picture of something. And I think that's going to be one of the primary uses. And the other thing has to do with agriculture. There's a lot of applications where farmers can do a better job of keeping track of how their farm fields are doing. And, in Japan, they've been using small unmanned helicopters to do crop dusting for over 20 years now. So our country is a little bit behind, actually, in terms of putting these things to use. And I think as soon as the regulations get put into place, you will see them proliferate quite quickly.
Are there any uses that you don't think most people have thought of? Agriculture, journalism, real estate agents, spying. Journalism has cuts a wide swath when it comes to the different kinds of journalism.
Sure. Well, there was an interesting situation that occurred in the last fall in September when the flooding was occurring in Colorado, and there was a local company that develops UAVs, and they were. They came in to help out, and they were flying their aircraft to essentially survey, the conditions of the flooding and things of that nature. Now there was some governmental involvement that caused those operators to get shut down, unfortunately. But there are lots of cases where, being able to throw up one of these small aircraft and to be able to get eyes in the sky can be very helpful. This flooding was a great example because there was one incident where on one day the weather was so bad that the manned aircraft actually couldn't fly. But the unmanned vehicle, since there wasn't the danger of harming a pilot, could be thrown up and actually conduct some surveillance and see in certain places where the flooding was a particular concern.
Actually, it makes me think of a photo I just saw of a pretty large plane or small jet dropping a fire retardant on a forest fire out in California, and people were wondering about the pilot, and it makes me think you could use it for that too.
Oh, absolutely. Of course, you've got an issue of how much chemical you can actually haul, the
True.
Payload carrying capabilities. But certainly, within the context of the capabilities of the aircraft, yeah, absolutely. As I said, in Japan, they've been using small unmanned helicopters to do crop dusting for well over 20 years now.
How big could a drone get? Could it conceivably be as big as we want it to be?
Well, I mean, they can be as large as we can make aircraft. So, for example, one of the largest unmanned vehicles we have is called the Global Hawk that the Department of Defense operates, and it's the size of a very large business jet, effectively.
My guest is Michael Brausch. He is a professor of electrical engineering at Ohio University. He works with drones in the Avionics Engineering Center there. We'll continue our conversation. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Last week, the administrator of the Federal Aviation Administration talked about drone safety on NPR's All Tech Considered.
Well, the thing that we care about first and foremost is the safety of our national airspace system. And these aircraft operate very differently, and they operate in the same airspace with a wide variety of other users. We understand that Congress wants us to implement by September of next year, and our emphasis is on ensuring that we're able to do it very safely.
That's what we're talking about today. Still with us is Professor of Electrical Engineering at Ohio University, Michael Brausch. And joining us now is the Chief Lobbyist for the American Civil Liberties Union of Ohio, Gary Daniels. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Always a pleasure.
Is the ACLU interested in personal liberty or privacy when it comes to drones?
A little bit of both. Privacy is our main concern with drones. We're not anti-technology by any means. We recognize that drones can be used for a wide variety of positive purposes, but just like any technology that watches us, it can also be used to invade our privacy. And that's our main concern with drones, is that a lot of people are talking about drones and the coming age of drones, but here in Ohio, as well as many other places, we have no restrictions or regulations whatsoever on how those drones are to be used, particularly by law enforcement.
Right now, the FAA regulates them, such as it is, by pretty much banning any commercial use of them right now until they come up with those new rules in September 2015. What do you make of how the FAA is managing things at this point?
I'm not sure. I've been under the impression for quite some time that the FAA doesn't quite know what to do with drones, and they're not so excited about drones being used widespread. I think they're afraid of how this might all play out and some of the unforeseen consequences, but then they have Congress pushing them to act quicker and quicker to do this. But when it comes to the FAA and drones, it's been a lot like the economic recovery of the last several years, where we hear, the later half of 2009, expect a housing recovery. And then it gets moved to the first part of 2010, and then the later part of 2010, and then 2011. And we're seeing the same thing here with drones. But they're on the way, they're coming, and we're going to be seeing these used in a whole wide variety of applications and ways.
Michael Brausch said that they're using them, they've been using them for the past decade in Japan to crop dust. Is there any issue with the ban on commercial use of drones right now? Is it fair to ban that right now?
Mm-hmm. Our concern isn't so much with the commercial use of drones, except for where we want those regulations and restrictions, because fears and concerns about law enforcement using these to invade people's privacy. Well, other people can do that too, third parties, businesses, corporations, what have you. The Fourth Amendment, the Bill of Rights, only covers government actions, not private actions. So while most of our focus is on how law enforcement and government uses these drones, we do have the same concerns with private businesses and corporations.
There are so many uses for drones now. Farmers monitoring their property and crops, firefighters watching the progression of a fire, or maybe someday fighting the fire with it. Tourists use drones to explore Yosemite Park or the Grand Canyon, but that's banned now, I guess. They don't want them in the national parks. How do those kind of examples violate airspace? Is it just by accident that they might violate someone's privacy, and that's the concern?
That's right. The FAA right now has some general guidelines that they use where people can use drones for very limited uses, limited heights and lengths of where the drones will be flying. But of course, what private industry is interested in is using these for all kinds of things with, I think, probably as little restriction as possible. Because as you point out, it can be used for a whole wide variety of things, from zoning to agriculture to just about anything that you could think of that will make what people already do much cheaper and much more efficient. And that's exactly why law enforcement is interested in drones, too. So I think the possibilities for what we can use drones for are almost limitless. But again, private industry wants, I think, what they think are shackles off of them right now. And, mm-hmm. and they just, they want to be, they would appreciate some sort of regulation and restriction so that everybody knows what the rules are and they're not inadvertently violating anything, either the spirit of the law or the law itself. But there continues to be this tug of war between private industry, the FAA, and Congress.
Michael Brausch, we were talking earlier, we were looking at your crystal ball and talking about what could be in the future. And what about the private use of drones for just everyday errands, that sort of thing? Can you see the dry cleaner using them? Can you see the grocery store using them? You know, deliveries. I mean, Jeff Bezos from Amazon talked about it late last year that they might be using them to deliver packages. We now know that's probably pretty far off in the future, not very practical, but I'm kind of getting dizzy thinking about all these things buzzing around above us.
Well, I think that's a good point. The statement by Amazon about using UAVs to deliver books is it was an interesting video. I think it allowed the public to see that, well, wait a minute, there are uses for UAVs other than for surveillance. But from a practical point of view, I don't think we're going to be seeing that anytime soon. And part of the reason is that, you know, frankly, it's probably going to end up not being very economical for folks to deliver things in that way. And then as another practical matter, you know, when we see the regulations finally get put into place, there's going to be some requirements for keeping track of the plane, making sure it's not flying over densely populated areas, and then there will be requirements for maintenance and you know, making sure that they're in good working condition, making sure that they can avoid other obstacles and other vehicles and aircraft. And by the time you satisfy all those requirements, it gets to be a little bit expensive to have a vehicle deliver your beer out into the middle of a frozen lake.
What are you reading my mind? You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm talking with Gary Daniels of the ACLU of Ohio and Michael Brosh. He's an engineering professor at Ohio University. He works with drones there. If you have a question or comment about drones, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. If you own a drone out there and somebody wants to give us a call and tell us what your drone is like and what it's like to, supposedly it's just for recreational or hobby use at this point is the only thing that's allowed, give us a call too, 614-292-8513. We were talking earlier, Gary Daniels, about a realtor who uses a drone to photograph a property she's trying to sell, and she said she planned to use drones for all of her properties. Are you concerned about that kind of casual commercial use and any ramifications from that?
Generally speaking, no. I mean, once again, the ACLU is not anti-technology. We recognize all of the wonderful uses that technology, whether drones or otherwise, can bring. But again, it goes back to, I think, the main ACLU concern with this is how does law enforcement use this? And when it comes to privacy laws in this country and the way that the courts have looked at this, they've basically said once you step outside the door of your home or your apartment where anybody can see you, law enforcement can see you too. And so what's the problem with us surveilling you what is essentially 24/7, because you don't have that, what the courts call expectation of privacy once you go outside your door. But the law and the courts and legislators around the country, I think we're starting to see a change in that type of thinking, because the old way of looking at this was always pre this type of technology, whether mm-hmm. it's drones or cell phones or GPS devices. But the world has changed, and we can't use these old ways of looking at these types of privacy laws and matters in a new technological age.
So the FAA is looking at safety rules and regulations for commercial use of drones. Who's looking at these questions that you're bringing up now?
That's a very good question. There's a few bills in Congress right now that aren't progressing very far, and that's been a very real frustration with Congress and privacy laws, is they tend to not be moving very quickly or very effectively. So a lot of privacy advocates, such as the ACLU, are relying on states to regulate these things in within their own state borders. Here in Ohio, the ACLU has been working very closely with legislators on both sides of the aisle, to the extent that there are now three bills in the Ohio General Assembly to regulate drones. And there's one that appears to have taken first place over over the other two that is moving along. And we're very hopeful by the end of this year, which will be the end of the session over at the State House, that we will have some very real and effective drone regulations in place. But it's going to take a bipartisan effort.
Will it be primarily law enforcement related?
It's focused entirely on law enforcement and law enforcement use of drones.
What are some of the things in the legislation as it stands?
Well, for instance, I mean, the ACLU's fear of this and other people's fear is that with the current state of the law and there being no regulation or restriction on law enforcement currently in Ohio, that if law enforcement wished to use these things 24/7, there's nothing currently stopping them. So all of the bills that are in the Ohio State House right now would have some sort of warrant requirement. Before you
like
deploy
a search
drones.
Warrant.
Right. Now, under emergency circumstances, true emergency circumstances, even the ACLU says and the courts say you don't need a warrant. You know, if you know somebody's, you know, there's a danger to life, you know, there's a very serious situation going on, go ahead and deploy those drones. But what we don't want is because law enforcement has the capability and the inclination, we don't want them just using drones and drone type technology. So these bills, depending on which bill you're talking about, they all have a warrant requirement, and a couple of them include don't weaponize the drones, an audit procedure, so people know how these are being deployed and why they're being deployed.
When they're being deployed, okay.
Deployed, right, transparency measures, mm-hmm. and a variety of restrictions and regulations, I think, that'll give the public more confidence that people can go ahead and use this technology, but that their privacy is being protected.
So, Michael Brausch, here I go again. I think I watch too much science fiction, but when I'm thinking about drones and firefighting, for instance, I'm thinking of a drone that can circle a building and figure out whether there's something living inside of that building and where people are inside of it. Is that kind of those sensors you're talking about going into the future that we could expect drones to have?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We like to talk about the primary uses, at least. In the past, we thought of the primary uses of drone technology was the 3Ds, jobs that were dull, dirty, and dangerous. and certainly, if you're having to go into a collapsed building and looking for survivors or something like that, obviously that falls under the dangerous category. Yeah, absolutely. We would love to have a small drone that can operate like a helicopter and go into a collapsed building and actually go looking for casualties, looking for survivors. And there are plenty of researchers out there that are working on just that.
Bob in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine, thank you.
It just seems to me like this is one of those innovations that's so powerful it can only be used for good or evil. Haven't heard anybody talk about the potential threat to the country that could be perpetrated with drones. We spend billions and billions of dollars in this war and all this stuff that's supposedly making us secure. You know, I think back when Clinton was in, somebody flew a small plane into the White House. Nobody really took it serious, thought it was kind of a joke, and what happened a few years later. I find it amazing that while a lot of money can be made on this, it seems to me that it creates a huge vulnerability. People can make their own. They don't have to follow the rules and regulations. And I don't know how it's going to be preventable. Does that make any sense?
Yeah. I mean, I hear you. Gary Daniels, you want to?
Well, no, that's absolutely right. I mean, you were talking about Amazon later. People can go on Amazon right now and buy a drone for not much money. And the FAA, law enforcement, whomever wants to keep track of these types of things, they can't keep track of it all. And for law enforcement purposes, you have drone manufacturers advertising these things either now or coming in the future. We can weaponize them. We can put facial recognition technology on them. We can put infrared technology. And, of course, there's usually not a way to build the wall high enough where if people wanted that as part of their own drones, that they couldn't make that possible. So, sure, while law enforcement is always a concern, we have to worry about how other people might use these for uses that they were not once intended for.
Michael Brausch?
You know, as a private citizen, I certainly don't want one of these things hovering outside my bedroom window. I mean, there's no question about that. So I absolutely support laws that, that ensure our privacy. I don't want a person holding a camera standing outside my bedroom window either. Mm-hmm. I certainly don't want a drone doing that.
Thanks a lot, Bob, for the call. And Jonathan in Columbus. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. Thanks, Jeremy. I see the last caller touched on what I was saying. I'm wondering, say I'm a celebrity photographer and I go out and stand in the public street in front of Brad Pitt's estate and I have my drone just floating in the air over his pool taking pictures, what possible regulations can be able to stop that? And I can take my call off here.
Gary Daniels, can they make rules that would ban that sort of thing and control it?
As the legislature has concentrated on government and law enforcement use of these, they've started to ask about, well, how do we prevent these exact problems? And so far, there hasn't been a great answer for that question.
You can have a rule against
but... And there are laws in place for such things as menacing and harassment and trespassing and a variety of current law that sort of fits into these situations, but not always quite. And so I think for quite some time, we're going to be struggling with how do we handle it when your neighbor wants to do this or when somebody wants to follow you down the street while you're doing this. And I heard you talking with the other guest earlier about how big drones can get. And I think what's going to be particularly worrisome in the future is how small they can get, because there's already drones out there that have like a 6-inch wingspan. Mm-hmm. And the military for a number of years has been experimenting with drones that are insect size. So I think in the future, it won't be so much one drone mm-hmm. we're talking about, but dozens or hundreds of drones that are deployed all for the same purpose.
Did it write Michael Brausch that size goes both ways?
Oh, absolutely. And I think this is touching on one of the reasons why the FAA has had a hard time getting the regulations in place, is because there's such a wide variety of platforms, such a wide variety of uses. And for example, the model aircraft community has always fallen under the guidelines that you don't fly over populated areas and things of that nature. And historically, that wasn't a big deal, because in the past, what you had were fixed-wing model aircraft, and they needed several hundred feet of open field in order to be able to take off and land and operate. And so by the very nature of their operation, they had to be away from the city. You found a model aircraft flying field outside of the city limits generally. But now that we have these vertical lift quadcopters, multi-copter type unmanned vehicles that you can buy literally off of Amazon, you don't have those restrictions anymore. You can operate them in your living room, for crying out loud. And so that's made it really hard for the FAA to figure out how to put the proper regulations in place, because you can't just say, well, make sure you don't operate it over. Populated areas. Well, okay, so now I'm the real estate agent who wants to put it up 20 feet in order to take a picture of the house. Well, is that a populated area or not? Mm-hmm. And so actually defining rules turns out to be a lot harder than it sounds.
Okay, well, Gary Daniels, we have to say goodbye to you. Thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Same here.
Gary Daniels, he's chief lobbyist for the ACLU of Ohio. We'll continue our conversation about drones. We're going to get more specifically into journalism when we return. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm Ann Fisher. Drone use by journalists has been in the news recently, most recently when post-tornado footage was taken using a drone in Arkansas. Is this a valuable tool or a form of commercialism currently banned by the FAA? Still with us is a professor of electrical engineering at Ohio University, Michael Brausch. Joining us now is the director of the Drone Journalism Lab at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, Matt Waite. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So there have been a few cases against drone journalists. First of all, let's talk about the prevalence of drone journalism. How do we characterize that at this point?
I would call it sporadic. The cases that we've seen around the country have generally been hobbyists freelancers, contract photographers. They haven't been the news organizations themselves, because most news organizations are aware that the FAA kind of takes a dim view on this, in spite of the twists and turns there, and have mostly stayed away to avoid legal bills. So it's going on. It's actually more prevalent in commercial photography and commercial videography than it is in journalism, but that's not to say that it's not going on.
Filmmakers are using these drones for aerial shots, even though they're illegal. It seems like a lot of people are ignoring the laws. Do we have a handle on how much of that's going on?
We don't, in terms of any official numbers or anything like that. But it's getting to the point now where I can't turn on the TV and not see something that I at least suspect was shot with a drone. There are commercials on television all the time. I saw one for the Iowa Board of Tourism just a week ago that was very clearly shot with one. There are commercials for water parks on the internet that are very clearly shot with them. There are TV shows. There are reality television shows, primarily, that there are just shot upon shot upon shot that are being done with them. So it's safe to say that in that part of the world, yeah, it goes on fairly routine, but nobody's talking about it.
Michael Brausch at Ohio University, they have the very esteemed Scripps School of Journalism. Have they contacted you?
No, we haven't. No inquiries to date.
Okay. So, Matt Waite, tell us about what you are teaching about drone journalism at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
Well, very specifically, I don't offer a class in it, precisely because of all of this, the issues with the FAA. I would summarize this more as a moral quandary than anything else. I have a really hard time charging students tuition to learn a skill that they can't use when they leave the building, and I've been pretty resistant to having a class, although I'm certain that will change as soon as kind of the FAA's posture changes. We've been working on getting a certificate of authorization that might open up some opportunities, but the students that I work with are paid through grant funds, or they are volunteers. They just are really interested in this and want to learn about it. And so what we have been talking a lot about is this kind of intersection of ethics, law, and policy, largely because we can't go outside and fly around anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I have one student in particular who has had some opportunities to travel abroad, and he's done some work. He took one of our drones with him and did some documentary filmmaking in India and did some pretty amazing work flying around an endangered animal conservatory in Kenya, and was flying, eye level to giraffes. And it's just breathtaking video. I mean, he did a wonderful job with it.
What do you envision for drone journalism?
Honestly, I think the first thing that's going to happen when the skies get opened up a little bit more is that it's going to become a tool pretty much like a smartphone. It's going to be a tool that's used when the time is right, when the situation calls for it, when there is something that would be enhanced by a photo or some video from the air. So severe weather, particularly large fire, anything like that, anything where spatial extent has some relevance, I think is where it will first go. But I think the ultimate frontier is for journalists to be using them to gather data for investigative reporting, for accountability journalism, to look at land use patterns or environmental degradation or something along those lines, where using a sensor other than a regular camera would be highly valuable. Now, that's more difficult. That requires a whole other level of expertise that mm-hmm. aren't exactly common in newsrooms, but there are partnerships to be had. There are skills to be built, and I think that's ultimately where it will go.
I'm kind of visualizing something sketchier. I'm visualizing, say, a television station, as soon as there's a big pileup on the interstate, sending out a drone first because it'll take too long for the reporter to get there.
Well, that's a more distant idea, because you have to understand that the flight times on the smaller multi-rotors that are pretty commonly and conversely available right now. They have a flight time anywhere between, say, 8 and 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
You might be able to get that up to 20 minutes. That's not very far. At best, you could maybe go 3/4 of a mile, maybe a mile, but you wouldn't have any time on site. It'd pretty much just go that mile and come straight back if you wanted to get it back. You know, I sort of date myself with this when I say, you know, the thing that I've envisioned is the OJ chase through
yeah.
Southern California. And that's something you could just really not do with a small UAV right now. The place for manned helicopters still exists. The sketchier place that most people go is not the pile up, but the celebrity wedding or the
there's that
and I honestly think that too sort of suffers from this battery problem, that if you're really wanting to stalk Lindsay Lohan and wait for her outside of a restaurant in L.A., you better bring a truckload of batteries with you, because you're going to be swapping them out every 8 minutes or so, and it's just far more efficient to put somebody in a Toyota Prius with a long telephoto lens and just have them wait.
Michael Brosh, what about that battery? We've kind of referred to it frequently over the last 40 minutes or so. What about the battery technology and how that's going to affect the viability of using drones for these kind of things?
Well, I agree completely with Matt, because you've got the basic physical constraints that in order to put more energy into the battery simply has to be larger. The current lithium polymer batteries that are common in the consumer electronics devices are excellent batteries. Their energy density is quite high relative to what we had 30 years ago. But nevertheless, these motors on these drones consume a lot of electricity very quickly. And so if you want to have a lot longer flight time, you got to have a lot larger battery, and then you're kind of eating your own lunch, because you're carrying payload, which is the battery itself. And yes, it is possible to have large batteries that will carry you for a longer flight times, but then you're talking about a much larger vehicle, and that gets to be expensive. The other thing is, these devices are noisy, and I wouldn't surprise me at all if we have if laws get put into place simply from a noise abatement perspective. You throw one of these things up, you're not carrying it on a conversation close by.
What about what the drones that the military uses? How do they manage that?
Well, they have a couple of different ways that they handle it. One is that they are okay with a short flight time. If the drone they're using is quite small, they may only need it for 10 minutes. So a soldier deploys one so that they can look on the other side of the hill or the other side of a building. They only need the thing to be up for 10 minutes and come back. The vehicles that have longer flight times typically are gas-powered engines, and so that's an entirely different technology then.
We have an email from Gina. She says, farm use, fine. Emergency use and public safety, fine. But I wish that there were an interest group in America to protect our quality of life, not just individual profit. And I think that my quality of life would be much better with no commercial drones in cities. Do either of you think that's a possibility?
Frankly, no. There are far too many uses for these, and I think any kind of citywide ban on them is unlikely. Now, that said, it's going to be some time before you see a lot of use within cities. Most cities have an airport. That airport has airspace restrictions around it. There are legitimate concerns about the safety of people on the ground, particularly in urbanized environments. You have a fair to middling college football team there in your fair city. You know, in spite of your games being, you know, sparsely attended, I don't think we want anybody flying. Yes, this is the Nebraska guy talking here. You know, I don't think we want people flying these things over, you know, the big game on a Saturday. If it goes down, somebody's going to get hurt. Mm-hmm. Now, that could be extended to downtown areas. That could be extended to parks. It could be extended to all kinds of things. So when people talk about needing regulations in place, and when I talk about the need for regulations to be in place, I am specifically talking about the safety of people on the ground, and particularly in urbanized environments. The FAA has said pretty explicitly that the uses in urban environments are going to be the slowest to come along, and they're going to be the most limited for quite some time. So she may ultimately get what she wants, but not in the way that she thinks it's going to be, and it will only be temporary.
We were talking earlier about with Gary Daniels from the ACLU of Ohio about their concerns with law enforcement use of drones. And one of the topics that's come up in the legislation that's pending in the Ohio General Assembly is that of transparency. And from a journalistic point of view, I imagine that's of some interest as well.
It is. I think that journalists should be particularly interested in knowing who is using these devices. And, you know, consequently, I think they're going to have to be willing to accept some transparency measures. That if your news organization is going to own and operate these, you had better be willing to disclose who you are, you know, make sure that your employees are licensed with whatever licensing scheme ends up being put into place by state and federal regulators, that you should disclose when and where maybe. Those are under discussion, that there be some public listing of drone flights that people can consult and look and see, you know, who was that flying around my neighborhood and what were they doing. Where I think journalists should be concerned about those transparency issues is when we get into issues of approval. There are some advocacy groups advocating for flight plan approval for each and every drone flight. Now, it's kind of laughable on its face in that it would be impossible to, I mean, the FAA doesn't have, you know, a tenth of the number of people that they would need to be able to do something like that. It would be a massive increase in the number of people with the FAA. But for journalists, having a federal agency deciding which stories you get to cover with a drone and not cover with a drone really smacks of prior restraint. And the First Amendment and the courts have said no, that's not permissible. So I do think transparency is a very important part of this, and you know, good for the goose, good for the gander. But it's a qualified endorsement of that.
And you mentioned that a student of yours has gone overseas with a drone, and you talked about some of the amazing footage he or she was able to get. There aren't the same kind of rules overseas. People are able to use them. Have we learned anything from what's going on over there?
Yeah, there's essentially three groups of countries in the world. The U.S. stands alone with this hobbyist, yes, but everybody else, but the government, no. There are several countries like Canada, the UK, parts of Scandinavia, Australia, Japan that have rules in place, and there's a licensing setup, and you can become a licensed UAV pilot and do commercial work with them. The vast majority of countries after that, there really are no rules at all. Australia has had UAV rules in place for some time. I want to say going back to 2002. Their aviation regulator just proposed new rules for UAVs that would basically deregulate small UAVs below 4.4 pounds. That if your device is less than 5 pounds, they don't care. They've just decided that the risks are so low that the threat to injury, things like that, is so low that. And frankly, that they don't have the ability to regulate that many of these devices, that they just have given up on it and just said, okay, so long as you comply with these certain rules, we don't even need to know about you.
Matt Waite, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Matt Waite, he's director of the Drone Journalism Lab at the University of Nebraska, Lincoln. And Michael Brausch, thanks to you as well.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
Michael Brausch, he's professor of electrical engineering at Ohio University, and where he works in the Avionics Engineering Center. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.